afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our final 3CL Trevor Smith lunchtime seminar of the present academic year. And we've got a very fitting speaker to round off the programme. I'm delighted to introduce Professor Stephen Schwartz, who many of you will know already, or at least know of. Professor Schwartz is most certainly one of our highest profile speakers we've had, over the pleasure of having over the last couple of years. And we're delighted to grab him when he's in the country, based in London at the moment. Stephen is the Stanley A. Starr Professor of Law and Business at Duke University, and also the founding director of Duke's Global Capital Market Centre, or now called its Global Financial Market Centre. He's got extremely broad research scholarly interests, spanning insolvency and bankruptcy law, international finance, capital markets, systemic risk, which I think you're addressing today, corporate governance and commercial law. In our former life, Stephen was a partner at two leading law firms. He's also previously taught at Yale Law School, and he's the author of Structured Finance, A Guide to the Principles of Asset Securitization, one of the most widely used texts in the field, and has authored literally countless academic articles in various leading publications. Professor Schwartz has testified before US Congress on various topics, including systemic risk, securitization, and credit ratings agencies, and has advised several US and foreign government agencies in the wake of the financial crisis. His article in the Georgetown Law Journal, Systemic Risk, is the second most cited law review article of 2008, and he's also been recognised as the world's second most cited scholar in commercial and bankruptcy law. So, certainly a very prolific and high profile individual we have the pleasure of speaking to us today. And as I said, Steve will be talking about systemic risk amongst other things. The topic of his paper today is central clearing of financial contracts, an extremely interesting idea which I've just enjoyed reading in the paper that was circulated yesterday. I should add, before I pass over to Stephen, Stephen's happy to take questions during his talk as well as after his talk, so it won't be a blight for you to interrupt. So without further ado, Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And I'm going to sit over here, that way closer to you guys. When I was in law school, I remember there was this lecture hall where I had commercial law. And everyone was sitting in the back, and the first two rows were completely empty. And my professor was quite upset about that, I could tell. And so after class, I went up to him and I said, "Professor Farnsworth, I'll sit in the front row if you promise never to call on me." And he agreed. I did that. Okay, I will not call on you, but please call on me. Interrupt at any time. So, my topic, central clearing of financial contracts. This is an idea I came up with a few years ago during a conference with the Federal Reserve Board in Chicago. And derivatives contracts are centrally cleared. Now, let me explain what that means. I assume most of you know what derivatives contracts are. They're essentially contracts whose value is dependent upon the value of some underlying thing. It could be a very typical derivatives contract would be, let's say, a currency swap contract, a contract where two parties essentially say that a payment would be made one way or the other depending upon how the value of, let's say, euros and pound sterling change each other. It's been believed that the global financial crisis was created in large part through derivatives contracts, and I will at least question this belief, this assumption. But many government agencies, including the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, not to be confused with the successor to the Russian KGB, so the FSB, that some years back, they decided that, derivatives contracts are inherently risky, And we need to prevent the type of risk exposure that led to the financial crisis. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to recommend that standardized derivatives contracts all be cleared through central counterparties. When I use the word clearing, I include what's known as settlement. Clearing and settlement is the process by which, if you have a financial contract, the parties determine who owes what to whom and how securities should be transferred. That's technically clearing. Settlement is the actual transfer of the cash and or the securities. But from a just nomenclature standpoint, for simplicity, most people in the industry refer to clearing as including both, which is what I will do. And so at this conference some years back, we were talking about central clearing of derivatives. And let me also say that the idea is that if you have these two parties, so-called counterparties, to a derivatives contract, again, at the settlement date, there'll be an amount that's owed from one party to the other party. The risk, the so-called counterparty risk, is that one of these parties may be unable to make that payment. And that failure to make the payment may cause the party to whom the amount is owed to have financial problems. That is part of the concern, a part of the concern. And to sort of address that concern, the central counterparty is a large entity historically associated with a securities or derivatives exchange that essentially takes on the responsibility to make the payment. It would be legally a novation where one party takes on the obligation of another party. So for example, if I am a party to a derivatives contract and it turns out I have to make a payment to you, I will not make the payment. The central counterparty will make the payment. Then the central counterparty then will seek reimbursement against me. But the idea is that the contract will be performed, okay? Now, to the extent this actually reduces systemic risk I define as risk to the proper functioning of the financial system as a system, okay? The ability for, you know, to sort of generate a healthy economy effectively. To the extent this protects against systemic risk, the question I had in my paper addresses is, should we extend central clearing beyond derivatives contracts to other types of financial contracts? And in looking at this question, I first asked, is there something special about derivatives contracts that makes them inherently risky that is not typical of other types of financial contracts? Now, to think about other types of financial contracts, think simply of a loan agreement. That's the most generic, most typical type of a financial contract. So should, for example, large loan agreements be centrally cleared through a counterparty? So if it turns out a borrower is unable to pay a lender when that amount is due, the central counterparty will, in fact, be directly obligated to make that payment. So in thinking about this, if derivative contracts are uniquely systemically risky in ways that differentiate them from loan agreements or other types of financial contracts, then maybe the central clearing thing doesn't make sense because it could be expensive and it may not have the benefit. But if there are parallels between the systemic riskiness of derivatives contracts, and other types of financial contracts, then maybe central clearing should be extended to other types of financial contracts. Now, my analysis does not independently analyze whether central clearing actually makes sense for derivatives contracts. Okay? My analysis essentially starts with the observation that we have this central clearing for derivatives contracts, and if that makes sense, then let's see if we should extend it. So it's a normative argument based on a limited positive law of reality. In looking at what it is about derivatives contracts that make them systemically risky, I had my research assistants look at the literature, and it's remarkable. There's very little out there that actually discusses whether or why derivatives contracts are systemically risky. And so I went through potential hypotheses. One idea is that derivatives are systemically risky because they are debts, okay? The idea is that derivatives, when two parties bet on how the, let's say, exchange rates will vary. But all financial contracts are debts. If I make a loan to you, I'm betting you're going to repay it back with interest on some date in the future, which could be in the far future. So I don't think that is fundamentally what differentiates it. Another hypothesis is that derivatives are inherently risky because they're volatile, that the amount that is paid can change greatly depending upon the underlying values. And here, and this might even create indeterminate liability, but here I actually looked into it and it turns out that the accounting profession has been worried about this possibility, and they've huge amounts of money and effort has gone to study it, and there are all sorts of models that the accounting industry is comfortable with, and government regulators that regulate the accounting industry are comfortable with, that can estimate the limits of potential liability on derivatives contracts. And these actually under, let's say in the US, under generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, these models must be gone through and the limits must be estimated. So I don't think that the volatility and the indeterminacy of the limits fundamentally differentiates these contracts. And that leaves, as far as I can tell, me one other factor that might explain why derivatives contracts are inherently systemically risky, and that is the fact that most of these contracts have one or more sort of large, interconnected counterparties, okay? Large financial institutions that are interconnected with other financial institutions. And that appears to be the key to the systemic riskiness of derivatives contracts. The only research I've found that actually looks into this corroborate my hunch here, and it seems to make some sense. So assuming that's correct, that it is not the nature of the contracts per se, but the nature of the parties of the contracts that create the systemic riskiness, then the question is, what if we were to ask, should non-derivative financial contracts that have at least one systemically important counterparty, should they be centrally cleared? And that is what my article ultimately focuses on. And in looking at this, I said, you know, we're going to require central clearing. This is a regulatory issue. Regulation should, at the very least, engage in a cost-benefit analysis to see if the proposed regulation extending central clearing to non-derivative financial contracts is justified by, you know, the benefits exceeding the costs. So I look at the cost-benefit analysis, and I start for, you know, get some grounding with the cost-benefit analysis that applies to central clearing of derivatives contracts themselves. Remarkably, there is no cost-benefit analysis. The FSB, when they recommended this, and countries, when they followed the FSB's recommendation and promulgated these laws requiring the central clearing, did not engage in cost-benefit analysis. The FSB doesn't even mention the cost of benefits. It simply assumes this is going to be a good thing. The United States, which is big in cost-benefit analysis, did not do it because the Dodd-Frank Act, which implemented the FSB's recommendations, says that systemic risk is so important that you should protect it against it even without even considering the cost. So there's no cost-benefit analysis there. Implicitly, however, I say that there is at least one aspect that the regulators, the FSB, have really, you know, thought about, and that is the central clearing requirement, as I mentioned, is limited to standardized derivative contracts. And this, at least, should reduce transaction costs. So I now look at the cost-benefit analysis of clearing non-derivatives financial contracts, and I know I'm going to be running out of time shortly, so let me just do this very quickly. The idea here is that to the extent it can reduce systemic risk, it's hard to precisely estimate that, but systemic risk is so devastating. The financial crisis is estimated to have caused at least $22 trillion, okay, in harm, that any significant reduction, even 10% reduction, would be massive. The question, so that's the benefits. The costs are twofold. One is the transaction cost, and I think the transaction cost of clearing non-derivative financial contracts would be pretty close to that of clearing derivative financial contracts. The paper does observe that there is one difference vis-a-vis transaction costs, and that is that there's more what's called multilateral clearing among counterparties to derivatives contracts, but you know that's a minor amount. The other cost is rather inadvertent. If you are shifting from essentially counterparties to to contracts, clearing the contracts between themselves to a central counterparty, one or more central counterparties clearing these contracts, what you're doing is you're concentrating the systemic risk. And therefore, does this concentration inadvertently actually increase systemic risk on a net basis? Now, no one has adequately studied that. Even for clearing derivatives contracts, that is not adequately studied. And I have looked at this and I've asked, is there anything about clearing non-derivatives financial contracts that could concentrate systemic risk in these central counterparties more than clearing derivatives contracts does? And the only possible thing is that when you clear a non-derivatives financial contract, as I mentioned before in the transaction cost context, you don't have as much what's called multilateral netting. But I've studied the multilateral netting. What's amazing about reading about derivatives is you read all the stuff where people keep talking about the same jargon, and no one really gets into what's happening. And you can't, it blew my mind. I mean, so I couldn't find anything that even adequately explains multilateral netting, much less explains how it reduces systemic risk. You have these papers saying it absolutely reduces systemic risk, and here's why. And the numbers they use have nothing to do with systemic risk. You have other papers that say, no, it actually concentrates systemic risk. Professor Rizmokal, formerly of UCLL, who's now a barrister, has a very good paper that explains why he thinks it concentrates systemic risk. But the point is that I'm not trying to prove something. I'm trying to explain these concepts so regulators and policymakers can at least start thinking about these issues. And I sort of phrase this in inequality. If the benefits are centrally clear and derivatives contracts exceed this cost, which is an untested premise, then, again, subject to these differences in multilateral netting, then the benefits of centrally clearing non-derivatives financial contracts might also exceed this cost. So I don't want people to read too much into my paper. I'm trying to understand this and explain it. So having sort of posed that inequality, then I ask, can we protect the central counterparties in case we do, against the concentrated systemic risk? And I look at the existing protections and argue why either they would apply equally for central clearing of non-derivatives financial contracts as for central clearing of derivatives contracts, or they could be adapted to apply. And I also look at how the protections could be enhanced. I mentioned that historically, the central clearinghouses were affiliated with derivatives and other securities exchanges. They were essentially these protected entities. But over the last 10 years or so, most of these central counterparties have been spun off from the exchanges. And they're now independent profit-making entities, or they're part of larger profit-making groups. And this introduces the possibility that they could fail, just like any profit-making entity could fail. They are no longer special purpose entities. I use the example of one of the largest central counterparties, ICE Clear Credit. This clears most of the credit default swap CDS contracts, which I'd be happy to explain, because they've been mostly blamed for the financial crisis. Anyone interested in what a CDS is, I'll talk about it. But ICE Clear Credit is a subsidiary of Intercontinental, which, quote, engages in an aggressive acquisition strategy that has caused it to incur significant debt, and many aspects of its business also involve substantial risks of liability. Okay, so what if the parent fails? What does that mean for the subsidiary central clearinghouse? And here I suggest that the central clearing, CCP, central clearing parties, should be what's referred to as ring-fenced. And ring-fencing is a concept that essentially means that if you have an important critical entity, in the UK, for example, a retail bank, through Independent Banking Commission's recommendations, in outside of banking, an important utility that generates, let's say, electricity or power or water, these entities are typically ring-fenced. They are protected so that if one of the affiliates fails, that failure will not essentially infect or cause the insolvency or bankruptcy of the protected ring-fenced entity. And any essential contracts that ring-fenced entity needs to operate will have a backstop if the services are previously performed by an affiliate that may fail. Okay, so that's sort of the nuts and bolts of the analysis. And then finally, I say, this raises a number of interesting jurisprudential type issues. One issue is sort of a puzzle here. Why should regulators ever tell sophisticated financial institutions how to do their business? It doesn't happen too often. And the idea is that if sophisticated financial institutions are, by definition, sophisticated, they should know how to run their business. And they not only should know, but they have incentives to run their business for the benefit of their investors, their shareholders, and to some extent, possibly, their creditors. So why should government get involved? And the answer is that, well, if there is nonetheless a market failure, why would there be a market failure? There could be a market failure because protecting your investors does not necessarily protect the public, okay? And there could be things that happened that actually motivate companies, even sophisticated financial institutions, to engage in excessive risk. The classic example would be government deposit insurance of banks. So bank deposits in many jurisdictions, in the U.S. is government guaranteed, other jurisdictions has the equivalent of a government guarantee. But the belief is that this government or quasi-government guarantee fosters moral hazard. Moral hazard is a tendency of someone who's protected from one's, you know, the harm of one's risky behavior to engage in that risky behavior. If anyone here has a car and you pay insurance in the car, you almost certainly will have a deductible on the insurance. And the insurance company charges, you know, it basically is a deductible so that you will have to pay the first 1,000 pounds or 2,000 pounds of harm to the car before the insurer will pay, and that is intended to protect against moral hazard, to protect against the possibility that you think, hey, I can run my car off the road, it doesn't matter what I do, I'll be completely, you know, reimbursed by the insurer. They don't want that to happen. They want you to drive safely, take care, park in a safe place, and so forth. And, you know, so that illustrates moral hazard. Now, the idea of government deposit insurance creating moral hazard is that the bank doesn't worry about the depositors. They can be taken care of by the government, so the bank can act recklessly. Whether you believe it or not, all the regulation that imposes capital requirements, including the Basel Accords, are largely based on that theory. Okay, but that theory and that literature doesn't fully inform why regulation should require central clearing of derivatives contracts or non-derivatives financial contracts for financial institutions generally that are systemically important. Many of them don't even take deposits, okay? And here, it's the same externality concept. The idea is that if there's a systemically important financial institution, and this institution acts aggressively, it could make a lot of money for its shareholders. But if that aggressive action fails, the harm that is caused is going to be externalized to the public, either through a bailout of government money, or if there's no bailout and turns out the failure causes a systemic collapse through, you know, the real economy being screwed up for everyone else. And that those externalities, the regulation, that's a market failure, those externalities. The market failure arises, so the theory goes, from the moral hazard of the systemically important institution, thinking it is, as regulators say, too big to fail, okay? And so one of the, I think the justification for central clearing is to try to restrict those externalities. And furthermore, the way that central clearing, you know, the central clearing parties actually work is that all the systemically important firms that basically engage in central clearing are parties to the, you know, they're actually members of the clearinghouse, the clearing company, and they have contractual obligations to maintain the capital level of the Central Clearinghouse. So if, for example, the Central Clearinghouse clears a, you know, 100 million year, you know, let's say 100 million pound contract and can't get reimbursed and it's going to fail, then the members will contribute money to reimburse it on an equal and ratable basis. And this represents a mutualization of risk. And one of the questions I've been asked is whether mutualization of risk should be extended beyond Central Clearing. Maybe it should be extended even to investing, by systemic important partners. Another question that comes up is, okay, assuming there's a market failure, and assuming the cost-benefit analysis shows that the regulation is going to have a positive benefit, is that enough? And here's the question is, I'm asking, do we want something that is second best, or maybe we should go for a first best type solution? That is, maybe we should look at alternative ways to regulate. Maybe there's something better than Central Clearing. I raise the question, but I don't get into it. Finally, I'll say I've talked a lot about standardizing. Only standardized derivatives contracts should be cleared. My paper says that to reduce transaction costs, similarly, only standardized non-financial contracts, non-derivative financial contracts should be centrally cleared. What does that mean? What are standardized non-derivative financial contracts? And so when I was thinking about this a month or two ago, it was in the faculty lunch line for a presentation, and I talked to my colleague, Kim Kravick, who teaches our derivatives course. And I said, Kim, what does it mean, standardization? She says, I have no idea. People talk about it all the time. There's no definition of it. And it turns out that if you look, at least in the U.S., a standardized derivatives contract is a derivatives contract that a central counterparty is prepared to clear. Okay, that's sort of like a function method. Okay, that is interesting. But happily, the EU, get over the EU, okay? I'm not even going to get into Brexit. So the EU, essentially a committee of the European Securities Regulators, they are the only ones who actually tried to define standardization. And they said it has three components: legal uniformity, process uniformity, and product uniformity. Well, what does it mean? Legal uniformity means standard transaction documents. And my paper indicates loan agreements and many types of financial contracts increasingly, dominantly, are being documented on forms that have been set up for derivatives by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, the trade group. And the reason it's being done, at least in the U.S., is to gain the advantage of bankruptcy law safe harbor. But this is increasingly being done, so the legal uniformity is probably going to be met for a good chunk of loan agreements. Process uniformity, when you get down to it, only means that you actually record the numbers correctly and you do it on electronic records. Well, that's easy, okay? And product uniformity refers to financial products that have similar contractual features, and loan agreements, I show, are much more similar than derivatives contracts. So I think loan agreements, I think non-derivative financial contracts will easily satisfy the standardization test. And just to give perspective, I might contrast that with an area of law where standardization is really important, and that's letters of credit. Letters of credit now are essentially, they're like bank guarantees that are payable upon the, presenting conforming documents. And here, standardization is critical because you have these low-level bank officers that get all these forms, dozens, if not more, letters of credit each day. They don't have a lawyer next to them, and they have to make a determination whether the documents that come in conform to the letter of credit requirements. If there is not uniformity, they would have to exercise judgment, and that could introduce a lot of risk. And so in the letter of credit area, uniformity is critical, and in fact, the UCP, Uniform Customs Practices, and other laws on letters of credit make it clear that a banker looking at these forms should only look at sort of the standardized definitions of banking usage and should not attempt to look at anything else. So that's my formal presentation, and I'm hoping you have questions. You disappointed me by not having questions during the presentation.
Too polite.